It's 2020, and we're a little late on starting this season of the Whistleblowers. It's our 23rd episode. I'm Luke Decock, News and Observer sports columnist. With me, as always, John Clockerty, the Hall of Famer. And it's taken us a while, John, to get started this year. I guess we were waiting for something to happen, and now with Jay Billis's rant the other day, we have something to talk about. There's been plenty to talk about, obviously, and we'll get to that. But first of all, let's catch up. How are you?
I'm great. It's been good. Good holiday season. I'm not nearly as busy as you are. You've got a lot on your plate. I have very little. I get to watch a lot of games on TV, sitting on the couch and watching some games that my son's referee and other games. And, you know, you're the busy one, but it's good to get started.
Are you doing any evaluating or grading?
No, actually, I did some. Since I've been retired, I did some and had gone to the games and did some work for the ACC. But they asked me to continue to do it, but I thought that that I'd had enough, and I had the time, but I just didn't have the energy or the desire to do it. So I gave it up and not doing any evaluation.
You're truly retired. Finally.
Yeah, my golf game occupies most of my time, but I do like to watch basketball, and I watched some games last night, actually. We had a couple ACC games that were worth watching, and I stay in touch with some of the officials and Brian Kersey, their supervisor, and when he comes in town, we usually sit down, break some bread, and go over how his season's going. So, you know, I stay in touch. I stay close. I talk to some of the people in the league office, and it's always good. But as far as work, I'm not doing much of anything.
You stole my joke about your golf game.
Not good or not bad? What's that?
Well, just that you're spending all of your free time concentrating on it. I know the last time we played, I ended up walking away with a fistful of cash. So maybe you ought to go back to evaluating.
You intimidated me with your length off the tee. Yeah, but you know, we had such good weather. I played yesterday, and it's been so nice out that why not? I mean, it's either that or sit around and read history books.
Well, I would do that too. Let's dive in now that we're caught up on your golf game. How do you like? Do you get your new handicap?
Well, handicap always goes up during the winter months because I don't get the roll I need. And the cold weather is not conducive to golf, but it's not off very much. I'm fortunate to keep in the single digits, which I'm proud of, but I don't know how long that'll last. But
it didn't change with the new system?
Oh, it did change. I actually went down when they went down just one stroke, which I was lucky to do. But when they start taking your best 8 scores rather than 20 scores or so, they're just taking the good numbers.
That's true. Fortunately, you've got more of them than I do. Let's dive in. So Jay Billis posted his blog on ESPN.com, and a lot of it this time was about officiating. He was looking into sort of why we'd all agree, I think, that the quality of basketball and college basketball hasn't been as good this year. And there are several reasons for that. It's not a great freshman class of talent. A lot of players went pro last year. There's a better class coming in next year. The three-point line moved back. You know, we can go through all of that, and all of it's relevant in some way. But his comments about officiating are germane to what we talk about here. And my takeaway from it, and you may have a different one being on the inside, you know, I took away from his comments that he felt like it wasn't the officials who were doing a bad job necessarily. He felt like supervisors had sort of lost the plot. We're placing an unnecessary emphasis on things that he didn't feel were essential to the game. There were clear things that had been clear fouls the last few years not being called. And I'm going to quote him here, the demands on officials are quite frankly ridiculous, that they're basically being asked to police the coach's box. They're being asked to police all these areas of emphasis, and they're leaving behind the basic things they can do to improve the game of basketball, which we saw over the last few years with freedom of movement and physicality and things like that. So, all right, so that's a big summary. That's more than a summary. That's practically reading from the piece. But in your mind, John, you've been both. You've been an official. You've been a supervisor. Where's Jay right? Where's he wrong?
Before I answer that question, I think in reading Jay's article and his thoughts on officiating and poor play, I have a good relationship with Jay. Sometimes I think he does criticize officials when it's not justified, but as he points out in his article, for people that do TV work and so for not to question officials is just wrong. He says coaches are questioned, even the media questions some of the things that the announcers do. So I never had a issue with Jay at all, and I totally disagree in some of the things that are in the article that where he lays the blame for poor play, and I'll get into that. But I've always had a good relationship, and Jay's always answered my calls when I was a supervisor, and we talked it through. It was never a hard conversation, so I like Jay. But Jay, and there's far more in this article, Luke, that we can get into, because I've highlighted some things. But Jay is saying that the poor play in basketball, there's no bigger culprit than the officials. He says that in one of his paragraphs, and he quotes it. It's the officials that are put on a spot by the supervisor and the administrators, and the poor play that's going on right now is a fault of several things, but mostly the officiating. I disagree with that. And since I read the article, I talked to supervisors that are out there that I have a relationship with, that I worked with, plus officials. And one that I have a lot of respect for says, the poor play is because the players are not as good. The players today are not as good as they were 10, 20, 30 years ago. And Jay talks about, he doesn't blame the one and done. I blame the one and dones, because these kids are coming in, they're talented. This is simply my thought. They're talented. They're coming in as skilled freshmen. And before they learn how to play, they're playing so much AAU basketball where there's no discipline, no offense, no work on the defensive end. They're coming in and they're leaving before they really have matured to be a good player. When I look back, and I'm going to throw out some names, when I look at Rasheed Wallace and Vince Carter, and I look at Tim Duncan and Chris Paul, and I looked at the three-time Player of the Year at Virginia, help me with Ralph Sampson. These were all better players than are in the game right now. And I can keep going down to as far back as David Thompson, but let's not go there. Let's just go to Chris Corcione in that group. I would have a hard argument to say those players are nowhere near the level of play that existed. There are no Rasheed Wallaces. Now, there may be Rasheed Wallaces if some of these guys stayed a couple years. There is, Kobe White may be good as Chris Paul if Kobe White stayed. But he's out of here, and he's in the NBA, and when he was here, he was dribbling all around and shooting wild shots. He may not do that 2 years from time he entered school. And I refereed in the Big East. There's no Patrick Ewings or Derek Coleman's or Ronnie Cycles in this league. There are none. The players are the fault of poor play, not the referees. The referees are having to referee poor plays. And when that happens, maybe they don't look so good. But I can talk about, you know, Jay says it's the rules. The rules are hindering the referees. I'm going to stop there. You pick it up, and then I'll come back to what I think about the rules. Some of the rules are tying the hands of referees. I have no argument with that.
So we'll get to the point where you're in agreement with Jay shortly then.
No.
Okay, well, no. I'll say this about the talent
issue.
Did
I make any...
absolutely. I'll say this about that issue. Those players were older. I think that's the difference. I don't think those players were any better than players today. They certainly weren't as fit as players today. They didn't have the same strength training and nutrition as players today. Players today generally, as a group, shoot better and have grown up shooting longer shots. You don't see the big men, but the game isn't played that way anymore in the college or the NBA level. You know, you don't see those back-to-the-basket big men like you used to. You know, the NBA is a four-out, one-in game and a five-out game. You know, basketball has become, over the last 10 to 15 years, it's become a shooter's game. And the kids who are playing college basketball now come up as shooters. The big kids are shooters. The little kids are shooters. That's just the way that the game has gone. If some of these players stayed 3 or 4 years, I think if Zion Williamson stayed at Duke for 3 years, we'd be talking about him as the way we talk about David Thompson, because he was that kind of freak athlete in a different way. But you know, society changes, the game changes. Players aren't going to stay in college for that long when there's so much more money to be made. And quite frankly, if I could have made that kind of money after my freshman year of college, I wouldn't have stayed 4 years either. You'd be stupid to. If someone had offered me a job on Wall Street making $2 million a year because they liked my freshman year paper on the Vietnam War, I'd be gone. I'll go back and get my degree later. So the game has changed. The players have changed. When I say the game, I don't mean the game on the court. I mean the game of basketball. There's more international players. That changes things. You know, it's an evolution and things change. So
what you said is I agree with. That's not I my one of the things I said is these guys could be as good as Chris Paul. They could be. They're talented. When they come in here, they're talented. But they're not as talented as Rasheed Wallace was when he was a junior, okay? And if they stayed, they may be. And I use Rasheed because he was sensational, okay? Or some of them could be as good as Tim Duncan if they stayed till their senior year. This kid at Duke, no telling how good he would have been. But because the argument I'm going to Jay is because they don't stay, that the quality of play is poor, is not as good. It's not because, I think it is because of the one and done. He said it's not attributed to the one and done. It is contributed to the one and done. All those centers that were at Duke that left after 1 year, okay, were never as good as Christian Laettner. None of them. Okay, Christian Laettner was as good. They may have been as better than Christian Laettner when Christian Laettner was a freshman, but they were not as good as Christian Laettner when they were there. And the reason the game is so hectic and so poor is because of lack of experience. And I had 12 years of supervising officials at AAU. If these kids are coming from AAU basketball to NC State, Kevin only has a certain period of time to get them back to playing defense and running an offensive set. They don't run any offensive sets in AAU basketball. They don't play any defense. Let's not blame the referees. It's not the referees that Jay's saying it the referees' hands are tied because they got to call all these or they're not calling all these fouls that they're instructed to call. So that, and I'll stick to my argument is play is bad, but play is bad because the player's not as good as they once were.
Yeah, I think that's where we disagree. I think they're maybe even better than they once were. They're just not as old, and that's something everyone has to adjust to. And it's, you know, I think it's the game has changed because of that, but every team's that way. And there's still an unbelievable amount of raw talent, and there's still coaches who can get that out of their teams. Now, If you look at last year's Final Four, older teams were predominantly there. That was a year for older teams. Michigan State was an older team. Virginia was an older team.
Texas Tech.
Older team. Auburn, older team. So, you know, there is some value in having an older team. I think we'd all agree with that. And UNC's best teams were older teams. But that doesn't mean that necessarily is everyone else being young is the problem. Those four teams played a Final Four that was almost unwatchable at times. And they were all old players.
So it depends on how you like to watch basketball.
Well, I think that gets back to the root of this, though, is what do we want from the game of basketball? I think if you go back 3 or 4 years ago, when they were really pushing the freedom of movement, we were getting to a game that was more open, less physical, in areas where it didn't need to be physical, more room for players to create. You know, we can go back into block charge, because since the last podcast we recorded, I've got some block charge stories you won't believe. But, you know, the one thing college basketball has traditionally been bad at is we get caught up in the rule book and interpretations of it. And I'm not saying that anyone's making the wrong call. I'm just saying the way the rules are written and enforced, we end up rewarding unathletic plays and penalizing athletic plays. So, you know, a guy goes in for a dunk and some schlub stands underneath him and gets trampled, and we're rewarding that. But that's not what anyone wants to see. People mm-hmm. want to see the dunk. They want to see the shot. They want to see the skill. That's what makes basketball great. That's what I think is the issue here when we start talking about officiating. Look, the players aren't as old as they once were. They're not going to be. That's not going to change. What do we have to adjust in the game so younger, very talented players and older, slightly less talented players can all play a game that we find attractive and entertaining and enjoyable to watch, not what we have this year? So that's where we get into more than the crux of Jay's argument, which I think has merit and you do not.
Yeah, and I'm going to argue a point with you, because I think you're right about a cultural change here. And I don't know if you're saying this, Luke, but first of all, one of the other reasons why the game is not attractive to me and is not as entertaining to me is because so many teams want to play fast and want to score a lot of points and want to put points up on the board. And when you do play fast and you're not as skilled, it leads to foolish fouls. It leads to turnovers. It leads to bad shooting percentages. It leads to fewer assists because one guy is coming down, passing it, shooting it. Everybody wants to put points on the board. Everybody wants to play fast. To me, there's no entertainment in that at all. You give me a team, and you will recognize this, others won't, but you give me a team like Temple and John Chaney, or a Virginia, or another team that says, okay, we're gonna cherish the possession of the ball. We're not gonna have a lot of assists, and we may shoot the ball bad, but we're gonna get a shot most of the time, rather than have 25 turnovers, empty possessions. That's not good basketball. That's weak basketball.
So is North Carolina's traditional style of the break and secondary break and trying to, you know, Roy with his hands scooting them up the court, is that bad basketball?
No, that's his basketball. Okay. If you're asking me, that's good basketball. When you have, I learned 40 years ago from a coach named Jack McCluskey, if your players are better than their players, you want as many possessions as you can, because your possessions are going to be better than their possessions. Make it as many possessions as it is. So Carolina always had better players. They traditionally had better players. So they want to, why not make it a fast game? They won championships with that. But I tell you, if you don't, there are teams playing that aren't nearly as good as Carolina was that are trying to play that way. And I'm looking and I'm thinking, they're all over the floor. The ball's flying out of bounds and the shots aren't even hitting the ring. This is awful basketball.
I think there's a lot of people who would argue that watching Virginia play is like getting a root canal sometimes. Yeah. So
if you're a purist.
I think that's a matter of taste. I think we're getting away from, is the game broken and what role do officials play, to what kind of basketball do you like? And I think the one thing I like about college basketball, opposed specifically to the NBA, and to a certain extent the international game, is that variety of styles. Teams that run, teams that slow it down, teams that play that structured offense like Virginia, teams that roll the ball out and run a ball screen and then figure out what comes next. Teams that people think do that and actually run a very subtle offense. And then teams that press, teams that sit back, teams that play pack line, 2-3, 1-3-1, we're going to trap, we're going to, you know, run and jump. All that variation that you don't see in the NBA. You know, in the NBA, it's very much variations on a theme, subtle X's and O's things, different systems and what, but it's all kind of a piece, as opposed to college where you have this very wide variety. You can have a league that has a Virginia and a Syracuse and a North Carolina and a Duke, which will run a different offense every year depending on what players they have. You know, that's what I like about college basketball. So to me, that's actually what you're describing is something that, you know, a stylistic thing with that's not you, for you as a purist. To me, that's what I love about it as a purist. And that's what I loved about the Big Five when I was in college, was you did have Temple playing the way they played, but you had Penn when they had the horses running, and you had LaSalle doing whatever it was LaSalle did, and Villanova under Raleigh, and all of that stuff. Like, you know, you had, even in this one very constrained geographic area where they were all recruiting the same players by and large, you still had this divergence of styles. And that's, to me, is what I enjoy about college basketball. It was one of the disappointing things about the Final Four last year to me, is that all four teams philosophically
were the same.
Were similar. They weren't the same, but they were closer to each other than they were farther apart. They, you know, there's a lot of differences in how they defended. I mean, Texas Tech and Virginia both, you know, have completely different defensive philosophies. Even if they, anyway, that's neither here nor there. But, you know, I like the variety of that, and I think there are teams that run and shouldn't, and there are teams that play slow who should be running. You know, you watch them all the time. You're like, just get your foot on the gas and play some basketball instead of trying to take the air out of the ball.
And it's good, really, that I hear your argument. It's good to agree to disagree. I sit and watch basketball, and I pull my hair out when I see all these turnovers and poor shooting and just throwing the ball away. I say to myself, just take care of the ball and you get a chance. And so yeah. You know, maybe that's in the, you know, like, maybe, and I don't want to always use Carolina, but maybe Carolina says, you know, if I can put 90 points on the board, I can accept 25 turnovers.
Yeah, they usually don't, though.
They're not that high, no.
Boy, well, Carolina would give a limb to put 90 points on the board this year.
that's true. You know, I'm not picking on Carolina.
No,
you know, but maybe a certain number of turnovers becomes acceptable because we're going to play fast. You know, I'm not in their dressing room, I don't know.
I'll turn this back to officiating with the same calculus on defense. A certain number of fouls, if you're Bobby Huggins, is going to be acceptable. Because we're playing aggressively and we're going for the ball, we're going to accept a higher number of fouls against our players because we're going to take those risks. Now, he may not with the crew.
He like it. Like, yeah. Right, right.
Right.
You but, know, but, that's a good point.
But
yeah.
But philosophically, yeah. You
we're going to foul more than other teams.
And everything's a true. I mean, you know, something as simple as, are we going to be an offensive-oriented team or a defensive-oriented team? That's a trade-off every coach, you know. So those are all trade-offs every coach has to make.
And, you know, people need to understand that probably Syracuse is going to have the least fouls of any team in the league. That's just going to be an acceptable factor because they're not out there trapping the ball and aggressive. So
they're going to be know what they're going to play. Which does, you know, and I think it's difficult to have the discussion that Jay's trying to have and we're having now this year, because not only is the ACC absolutely terrible, with maybe one or two teams that you would consider good ACC teams in a normal year. Everyone's pretty bad. I mean, I think the Big Ten's the only league that looks good right now, and maybe that's only by comparison because everyone else is so bad. It's just this year, 2019-20, for a confluence of factors, the kids coming in, the kids who didn't play college basketball and went elsewhere, whether it's RJ Hampton or Jalen Leke or any of those guys, you know, you lost some talent coming in. You lost a lot of talent last year. These things ebb and flow. They're cyclical.
That's the word I was looking for. So you think it may be cyclical?
Talent-wise, it is. Next year's freshmen are supposed to be better. Mm-hmm. We may not lose that many freshmen this year because there may not be that many who are worth going, who think it's worth going to the NBA. But let's get to the very first thing we talked about and circle back to what we were originally going to talk about before we got sidetracked with all this other stuff, which is Jay Billis right about officiating? And is he right that supervisors are asking too much of officials with everything that's going on in the game today?
This is a quote from Jay. All the demands upon officials have had a negative impact upon officiating and on the level of play. I will strongly disagree with that. Okay. I'll start with, even when I was a supervisor and there was a change occurring, Luke, about let's make this game of officiating, a lot of it as absolutes. You've heard that word before. If he does this, it's an absolute. It's an absolute. An armbar, it's an absolute. A knee in the back of a post player, it's an absolute. So they were taking much of the decision-making, the judgment, out of the officials' hands. And I will say that I think they did that because they thought the less decisions that the officials make it an absolute, the better the game will be as far as consistency. Okay. When I took the job as the supervisor back in 05, and even when I refereed, there was an area in the rule book originally, and you've heard this before, there was apply a philosophy of advantage, disadvantage, okay? And not all contact was a foul. And if the contact did not impede the progress of the dribbler or the shooter or the screener, if it did not have an adverse effect on that play, then don't interrupt the game. And for Jay to say the officials are as good, if not better, than the older guys.
Oh, that's what's bothering you.
No, I'm not going to.
You don't want to hear that.
I'm not going to argue, because the officials today work really hard at their advocation. They work at it. They study film and so forth. But they're not allowed to use their skills, overall skills, to call the game. They are told, you're going to call this and you're going to call this. So my last year, when Art Honan spoke about two hands on the perimeter player is a foul. Armbar, guy goes to the basket, puts an armbar on him, it's a foul. If he does this, it's a foul. He does that. I said, wait, Art. I said, Art was, for our audience, Art was the national coordinator. I said, Art, wait a minute. I says, how about the wordage in the book? We need to take it out. If you're going to do this, we need to take out of the book advantage, disadvantage. Because when my group, my era officiating, which you were my supervisor, you didn't want us to interrupt the game on contact that there was no advantage. You were my supervisor. I posed a question to him. And I said, so if a guy puts a hand on a dribbler or armbar and it has nothing to do with a play, are you saying that's a foul? He said, it's a foul. It's a foul. To me, that makes for weaker referees. That you're taking a quality referee. Jamie Lucky is a quality referee. Jamie Lucky knows what a foul is. I would trust Jamie Lucky in any game that I assigned. Jamie Lucky knows what a foul is. Trust him to know what a foul is. Don't say, Jamie, he touched that guy, so it's a foul.
Isn't the problem, though, and isn't how we got here, the fact that there were guys like you who could referee a game that way, but there just weren't enough of you? And for that second tier of officials who didn't have that understanding and that second sense of what the flow of the game, you know, the discretion and the understanding that you developed over years, one, took years to develop, and two, we got to a point where there were officials trying to call games like that and just losing the plot completely.
Yeah, that's what I said, you know, and you laughed at me. Maybe these guys are every bit as good as the Timmy Higgins and the Bobby Donatos and the Eddie Corbetts and the Johnny Cales. Maybe they are better, but give them a chance to be better. And your point is, I think they take a stereotype of referee, give him these absolutes, and he can referee any game because he's got these absolutes. You know, he's interchangeable. That's what the NBA wants. Yeah. They want interchangeable guys that can say, okay, put this guy because this is a foul. Don't even think about it. And that is what has gotten into the college game. And Jay is saying that because for 2 or 3 years we were doing all that. Now, you're a better judge of this than I am, Luke. You see more games, actually. They were doing that, two hands, the arm bars and this, and they were doing. And Jay is saying they've regressed. They're not calling it, and the game has suffered for it.
Yeah, I think his argument is they're calling so much other stuff.
Yeah, the flop and the...
Yeah, and look, I'm fine with the flop. I think that has to come out of the game. But they're calling so much other stuff that they can't also call these freedom of movement fouls, which were making the game better. I think no matter what style you like, it's a better game when you're not getting, you know, bumped, when cutters aren't getting bumped and knocked off pad. I mean, that's a great secret of the Princeton offense for 40 years. They fouled everybody.
Yeah.
You know, Pete Carril wasn't a genius. He just figured out if you fouled on every single possession, they couldn't call them all.
There was several coaches that were just, I can foul more than you can call.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the whole point of the Princeton offense and what Princeton did defensively is we're just going to grab and hold you. And, oh, hey, look, we got a backdoor cut. And everyone applauds. And, look, they almost beat Georgetown but didn't.
Well, I know that I know that Calhoun had some teams that had lockdown defenses.
I mean,
they would strong-arm you.
The Big East, I mean, that was half the Big East was
yeah,
forcing guys like you to call all those fouls. So
I made my points, and if Jay was sitting here, you know, I would say the same thing. Let's not put it – he said it's the obvious culprit more than anything else is the officials. I'm not buying that. I'm saying it's the players are not as good. That's not meaning they won't be as good. I'm repeating
right,
myself.
Right,
they
right.
will be as good, but there's no Tim Duncans out there right now. And maybe there is a Tim Duncan, but there's no Christian Leitner on Duke's team.
This was a bad year, and no one's fault. It's just the way it worked out. This was a bad year to move back to the three-point line because this is a bad year for talent in college basketball. So we've got, like anything, it's not just one thing. We've got several factors that have collided here. There's no question talent is down. It's not as good a year. Moving the three-point line back, even though all the coaches say it doesn't make a difference, how many times
this year... It does make a difference.
How many times this year have you seen a kid put his heel on the sideline with the ball? It happened, I think, twice in the Carolina game last night. You never used to see that because kids still haven't adjusted to where the line is, so they're setting up where they used to, and now they're out of bounds. And I do think... I disagree with you here a little bit. I think I don't agree with him necessarily on the specifics, but I think he makes a valid point about college basketball officiating in general, which is we've gotten away from what was making the game better. It's not, and not maliciously, it's not anybody's fault. It's just mission creep and drift and kind of trying to do too much and then realizing after you've done it, you've maybe gone a little too far. I do think it's not necessarily like this year it's made it worse. I think because we see all these issues so more clearly this year, we're seeing some of the officiating changes. And I think Jay's right, and you actually alluded to it, with all these absolute fouls. Not only are you taking discretion away from the officials, which that's a debate. I'm not necessarily for or against that. You're obviously for it, and I totally understand why. I think there's some merits to removing that from the process. But you've made it the game so complicated and so manifold for officials to officiate that it's almost impossible to do a good job. You're serving too many masters. And we've got to get back to focusing officiating and enforcement on the things that really make the game better. Getting coaches back in the coaching box and getting the bench to sit down, it's not making the game any better. But we're spending an inordinate amount of time on bench decorum. We had a bench warning for Jeff Capel last night when he's trying to call a play and he's out near half court and he's trying to get a player's attention. And one of the officials comes from the other side of the court to point at him and warn him. Okay?
Why is he even looking over there?
I'm not blaming the official, and this is what I'm going to get to in a second with block charge. The official's doing his job. If he wants to work the NCAA tournament,
right.
He's got to be on film warning that coach. Well, what the? Why are we waste? It's like these stupid reviews for an out of bounds play with 2 minutes to go in a 20-point game. Why are we wasting our time with this crap? Especially when the out of bounds reviews, you get a replay that shows, you know, player A knocks the ball out of player B's hands, and the referee says, okay, well, that goes to team A, or team whatever. It goes to the player, you know, the team that lost the ball because you knocked it out. But then we go frame by frame in the replay, and hey, look, it touched the tip of his finger on the way out. It's actually, you know, the team that the guy, you know, the other team's ball. You know what I mean. No.
Your point, Luke, I'm 100% with you on this. First of all, you are putting far too much burden on the referee. You're going to talk about block charge, but first of all, they put the arc in. Okay, if a referee is worth his salt, he doesn't need the arc to call block charge. Either it was a block or a charge or a no call. Okay, but they says, wait a minute. Okay, we're going to help the referees on this play. He doesn't have to worry about whether it's a block charge. If the defender was in the thing, then it was a block. Okay.
Yeah, well, it's because your guys were calling too many damn charges.
but why do we need the arc? There's good referees who refereed for a century without the arc. But nope, we got to have the arc to help the referees. You know, we got to clean up basket interference goaltending. If the ball touched the backboard, okay, whether it's below the ring, above the ring, or if it touches the backboard and it's touched, it's goaltending. You know what? Everything is questioned now. I mean, like, does the referee, he has no decision making. I mean, it's just frustrating to me. But I think the arc's a good example. You were in talk block charge. Now we got the flop. I talked to a referee just recently. He said, John, some of these guys flop. And when Brian Kersey was refereeing and they flopped, and he thought they flopped. He said, next time you flop, he says, I'm calling a block on you regardless, and you won't flop anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what? Why do we need a rule to talk about? We're going to tee you up if you're going to fake a flop.
So I actually like the arc because I think my issue
is, I knew you'd disagree with me.
I'm not here just to disagree. We agree on a lot. We do agree on a lot. And big picture, I think we agree on more. But it would be a boring podcast if we just sat here and agreed
with each other. Nothing boring about this podcast.
Not that this is contrived. So at the Final Four last year, the NCAA invited a few media people, only a few of us could make it because of the timing, on Sunday, to meet with your buddy Art Hyland, who still does the rule book, and the members of the basketball steering committee. And some NCAA people, including J.D. Collins. And we just, it was very informal, off the record. I'm not going to speak out anything out of school here. I'm just going to kind of talk in generalities about it. But there were two or three of, I think three of us there, basketball type writers. And it was just a very sort of free form discussion about a lot of like what we're talking about. It was officiating focus, but it was more state of the game. And we talked about several.
I would love to have been a fly on the wall.
It was great.
I bet it was terrific.
It was a tremendous opportunity, and I was thrilled to be invited and thrilled to participate. But the funny, so I got on. Listeners of this podcast will know exactly what I said. I got on my soapbox about block charge, and I made my usual points. Right, where we should be rewarding the athletic play, not the unathletic play. I'm not saying officials are calling it wrong or the rules being applied wrong. I understand it's being called the way that it's supposed to be called. I just want to have a bigger discussion about whether this is good for the game, whether this is good for college basketball. And the play I used is when we, as an example, is when we talked about on this podcast last spring, It was one of the Martin twins, I think, for Nevada against Utah State. Took off from like the 3-point line and threw down this massive dunk. And some 6'2"
ran in,
raggedy Utah State player just kind of slid in underneath and got plowed. And I think it was probably the definition of a 50-50 call, just bang, bang. But refs love putting their hand behind their head and throwing that arm out. And that guy danced halfway down the court before he called that charge. And you take like what was the best play of the game and you penalize the kid for it. Because some kid who's not half the player he is slid underneath him. And okay, so if it's a charge, it's a charge. I get that. But I think my point was, one, the default is the charge. We've reached the point where if there's a 50-50 collision, especially with certain referees.
They love calling
like
charges.
Jim Boeheim did not go running around center court at
Cameron. They love charges.
Because he didn't know the official who made that call.
Right.
Like he knew when that he called that a charge and he was calling that a charge whether it was a charge or not. And that's, mm-hmm. I guess if you know that, you know that. But, you know, then the point I made was, you know, let's have a bigger conversation about, is this how we want the game to be played? And, you know, there's coaches in there, there's ADs, there's Power 5 commissioners in there. And, you know, the coach's point was, look, hey, that's a coachable skill. And I get that. Like, you can teach a kid to take a charge. So that's something my team can do if we're not as good as the other team. And I said, that's fine. I get that. I understand why you do it. My question is it good for the game? Is it good for the game that your less talented team can get an advantage over a more talented team by doing that? I don't think so. I think the NBA figured that out a long time ago. And I made the mistake in that session of using the word NBA, at which point...
Then you killed yourself.
Letting the dogs off
the
leash.
Yeah, you killed yourself then.
Next thing I knew, I was buried in...
Yeah, I was waiting to see what Art's response was, but when you said the NBA, I thought...
I wasn't comparing. I just basically said...
Is this good for the game?
You know, the NBA has taken a different approach. So I had the interesting experience of not art was great, of being basically dressed down for 10 minutes by a Power 5 commissioner at an event that was invited to attend
year you won't be.
At least I know what I can make plans for Sunday afternoon in Atlanta.
Oh, that's interesting.
Was there any
feedback about your
what? Well, all right. So this is the interesting part. As we were leaving the room, and everyone was kind of chuckling about it, a few of the people I didn't know from the NCAA, people inside the building in Indianapolis, kind of came up and said, "Thank you for saying that. That's the point we've been trying to make." So I don't know whether they have any power, or they were just being nice, or they disagreed but just wanted to be nice. But I have said it on this podcast before and we'll say it again. You know, I think as a game, college basketball needs to have a reappraisal of what we want to encourage. And I the old story about Jim Valvano at his basketball camp encouraging campers to jump out from behind corners and take charges on the counselors and the way to the lunchroom and all that. Like, it's part of the game and it's part of the lore and all that. I just don't know in 2020 is... that's still the way we want to be coaching and playing the game and officiating the game.
You know, guys like Art Hyland and Danny Gavitt, I would have been surprised if Danny Gavitt was one of the guys that came up and spoke to you afterward, because if you were to ever, if they were out of their positions, and I'm saying this, but they are doing what they think that the rules committee and the, is it a competition committee or something? That's a
steering committee.
That's what they want. But both Danny Gavitt and Art Hyland, they grew up in the Big East, and Big East was great, great basketball. You know, and maybe they do think that the game has gotten far too rough, too physical, and we have to take serious steps back to get back to where we need. Those two guys I know personally, but that was not and again I'm going back a few years, but that's not how they liked the game to be hit to referee the way it's being refereed now. They're laying down the law. Art Hyland and Danny Gavitt and whoever else, steering committee, they're laying it down, and Art has to enforce it. Supervisors have to enforce it. Johnny Cal was a terrific referee that never refereed under absolutes.
Right.
Never, you know.
And I should make one additional point just for purposes of clarity. My position on the charge is it should be a player control foul. If you're out of control, to me, the offensive player, the ball carrier, is out of control. Meaning, and we, you know, you see this called all the time, whether the guys, you know, even if the play, the defensive player is moving, if it's a charge, it's a charge. You know, I mean, if the guy, if you're guarding me and I put my shoulder down and you're in legal guarding position, I bully you over. That's a charge whether you're set or not. Like, let's call more of those. Let's penalize the offensive players who are out of control. Let's make this what it should be, a player control foul, and not a I got in your way foul, which is what it is too much of the time. And, you know, I think that makes sense. I understand. And, you know, you get back to talking about officiating with absolutes. That's a really tough way to officiate with absolutes. I mean, the way I just described, that's a discretionary call.
It is. It is.
And so it kind of brings us full circle a little bit. Anyway, that's my fun story from the Final Four, that and several meals.
Whoever came up to you, they were sincere when they told you thank you.
Let me take this moment to promote what was one of my best read stories of 2019. While I was at the Final Four, I went to Prince's old house and recording studio, Paisley Park, and I wrote a column about Prince the basketball player.
Did you?
And it turns out he was an excellent basketball player.
Somebody told me he was a pretty good athlete. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, really. Yeah, I'd heard that. So. Yeah.
Anyone who's seen the famous...
You've been to his place?
Yeah, they have tours now. It's great.
Okay.
It's crazy. Uh-huh. It's way out in the middle of the suburbs. You'd never know it was there. It just looks like a purple warehouse.
Oh, that's good.
Any listeners who have seen the Chappelle's show, Charlie Murphy, True Hollywood Story about Prince, will know the legend, and from everything we can tell, the legend is
Prince,
true.
Yeah.
Yeah, Prince could hoop. He could play. Anything else you want to talk about, John? I feel like we've covered a lot of ground. We didn't get into any of the NCAA bigger issues that we wanted to talk about.
The only thing that I wrote down, and I gave you a text or something, you know, being a basketball guy, and that, you know, spent better than half of my life involved in the NCAA, you know, I'm seeing this legislation, pay to play, and it interests me, fair pay to play, and I think it's a major, major problem for the NCAA. Luke, and I'm not just saying this, you are far more in tune with some of that stuff, because all I get is maybe some stuff on online that I read, but I know Mark Emmerich is looking for some help, trying to get Congress to maybe set some standards, some federal law. I don't think personally that Congress needs to be involved in setting federal laws.
No, if the NCAA wanted to do this, they could do it itself.
You know,
this whole
their argument, the NCAA, is we can't let each state has a different set of
laws.
Well,
then make your own.
You know,
I've sat and listened to NCAA lawyers argue in court.
I'm going to turn it over to you because I don't know enough.
A private organization, and that they're, you know, that they shouldn't be held, you know, that their rules apply to them and only to them, and no one else can force them to adopt different rules. That's their standard legal argument in any case involving someone trying to litigate one of their decisions about eligibility. We're a private organization. We make our own rules. All right, Mark. Go ahead.
Make your rule.
Make your rules. And the reality is the NCAA last year, when it had this much ballyhooed thing that we're going to look into NIL, which is name, image, likeness, rights, basically, can you do advertising endorsements, things like that? Can you profit off your image? Everyone's like, oh, yeah, the NCAA has approved it. And all they really did was say, we're going to look into it. But the people who said this isn't that big a deal, they were right in a practical sense. It didn't mean anything practically. Philosophically, that was actually an admission of defeat. That was the NCAA basically saying, we know we're not going to win on this. So now they're just doing what the NCAA does best and delaying. So going to Congress is a delay tactic. Eventually, I'm sure there'll be a lawsuit filed in California. That'll delay the implementation of that law, the Fair Pay for Play Act, the first one passed in California. But the trend here is clear. The reality is, whether it's by lawsuit, antitrust lawsuit, legislation, athletes are going to profit from their name, image, and likeness soon and without compromising their eligibility, because the NCAA knows it can't win on this, nor should it win on this. It's nonsense. Mm-hmm. That's the same actual argument that's going to apply to whatever the next step is, because the NCAA's restrictions, like the letter of intent, is an unbelievably restrictive contract that offers the player almost no rights. Technically, there's a pretty good legal argument to be made, and has been made, that it's not even legal in the state of North Carolina because of our laws about contracts that minors can enter into. So there's going to continue to be more change like this. And the NCAA's only strategy in the face of what's becoming increasing and will eventually become overwhelming public support for these kind of reforms is to delay and to create working groups and talk about it at the convention and lobby Congress and say, well, we can't do anything. There are state laws. We have to get a federal law. And it's all just a delay tactic. They're going to lose. They're going to lose badly. The longer they can hold out, the more money they can keep for themselves. But and don't forget, but the NCAA operates at the behest of the schools. Right. It's not like the IRS. This is what the schools want. Schools want to keep all that money for themselves too.
But when it's all done and so forth, and the states are saying we're going to have fair pay for play, and is it going to be a? Do you see it as a chaotic situation where each institution or each state or whatever sets their own standard? I mean, I don't want to use a specific school, but well, maybe not everybody's going to measure up to a Kentucky, and for what they might be able to do for their players that maybe Vanderbilt can't do for their players.
All right, well, Kentucky's got 13 scholarships. So let's say Kentucky has more money than God, and they get the 13 players they want. Well, the 14th player is now in a bidding war with everybody else. Like, I actually think that letting players cut deals with car dealerships, if you're a five-star prospect from Idaho, can you make more money staying and playing home for Idaho than you can going to Oregon? If you're a right tackle from Dallas, can you make more money at SMU than you can at Clemson? I actually think once you start letting these players put some value on themselves in football and basketball, you'll actually see the recruiting playing field get leveled. Because if you look at the four teams in the football semifinals this year, I think they're four of the top five teams in the recruiting rankings. Mm-hmm. When you don't have any financial inducements, players are going to pick the best programs. People say, NIL is going to make it an uneven playing field. What do you think it is now? Who's choosing not? If you're a five-star player, you're going to Clemson or Alabama or Ohio State. Like, there's no reason for you to stay home and go to Tennessee at this point. But with NIL, there might be reason. Or, you know, a bunch of boosters at UAB can get together and buy a great recruiting class. And you know what? That's the free market. Allegedly, that's America. I don't understand what's so wrong with it. As Kay has pointed out several times, basketball players have value as AAU players and prospects. Shoe companies want their support. Teams want them to play for them. They have financial value. They go to college, they have no value. So all of a sudden, what do you do? Well, you give them money under the table. And shoe companies give them money under the table. And whatever, all the stuff, the recruiting stuff. You give the uncle, aunt and uncle a washer and dryer. You know, the grandfather gets a new pickup truck. The whole deal. And then they go to the NBA and the money's back on the table. So if you can just get the money on the table in college sports, you get rid of a whole layer of corruption. You level the recruiting playing field because it gives players more reasons to go other places. And it's going to happen anyway. I mean, it's happening now. I mean, players aren't getting paid for their name, image, and likeness, but there's money being handed out. Maybe not as much as some people think, or maybe more than other people think. But it happens. We all know it happens. I mean, we've seen it in the court documents. I think that's going to happen, and I think it's actually going to be good. And I go back to, Like, if you go back and read the Title IX stuff, when Title IX came into law, mm-hmm. it was all the same stuff. It's going to be chaos. How are we ever going to balance our men's? This will mean the end of college athletics. It was the same sky is falling stuff. And you know what? Title IX was one of the best things that could happen to sports in America because it created the entire world of women's sports that we know now, which is, you look at the Women's World Cup, you look at women's basketball, these are popular, thriving sports that people want to watch and want to play. And quite frankly, girls and women should have had the opportunity to play those sports anyway. It was only because of, you know, the inertia of the system, the NCAA system. The NCAA refused to sponsor women's sports. Think about that.
Yeah, and it's...
Think about that.
Yeah.
And the reason they didn't, why? They couldn't afford it.
They couldn't afford it. It was going to bankrupt them.
It was going to bankrupt them. And you know what? They seem to be doing okay.
Yeah.
You know? Like Jim Delaney got a $20 million bonus for showing up for work.
Yeah.
I think he's doing okay for himself.
Doing okay.
You know? And he was the one who said, you know, if we keep going down this road, the Big Ten's going to have to go D3.
Yeah, right.
I'll eat my sweater if the Big Ten ever goes
D3. They don't have enough money, right?
They have their own network. I mean, the Big Ten's like like a third world country.
I know.
It's like a drug company. They have presses in the back printing out $100 bills. College sports.
They got so much money.
It's like a hedge fund. And the players do all the work, and they get almost nothing, relatively speaking. And we've talked about this before. My position is there was a time, not too long ago, when a four-year scholarship was a really fair price for what an athlete brought to a university. But you know what? When Dabo Sweeney is making what Dabo Sweeney is making,
ooh.
When assistant coaches are making $1 million,
plus
strength coaches are making $1 million, are you telling me players don't deserve a piece of that pie?
You won't get any argument. Of course, I've been a purist, and you know, last year I argued that point with you to where I probably embarrassed myself. But no, I'm in agreement with all that. I mean, when I see the salaries of a strength coach, and I'm thinking,
and the money these officials make.
Well, right. Not my generation didn't make, but. Now, next time we're up,
yes,
I want to maybe look talk about. I think along these same lines that the player. Why would a player not be able? Why would there be any rules that not allow a player to go directly from high school to professional sports like the NBA? Luke. If you talk about wrong, that is wrong, okay? And Kobe took advantage of it. LeBron took advantage of it. Others took, you know, and now they're saying, no, you got to go to college or you can't, the NBA, you can't be a certain. It would seem to me like NCAA, I don't think has anything to do with it. I think it's the NBA.
It's the NBA and the
but
union.
But you can't. Who? Tell me another profession that...
Yeah, professional football. You got to be 3 years.
3 years.
Out of high school.
Wow.
And that, you know, the reason that rule exists is because the NFL...
Let me ask you something. If there's a star golfer...
The kid from
Cary?
Yeah, Wake Forest. Akshay Batia.
You're going to make him go? No, but why? But
well, it's not even that. You know, you're a star violinist.
That's right.
Yeah, Natalie Portman went to Harvard. No one was keeping her ineligible from acting.
Good. You know, I don't get it. Why are you going to penalize the athlete?
Yeah, because they have the least.
They want to make money off of them.
They have the least power and they generate the most income, and that's an old story.
Well,
but that was good.
It was a good session.
Yep. Fiery.
Yeah,
got you all.
You did. All Jay certainly did, and I want to go back. Jay and I actually. I had him come to speak to our officials. He's open. He says one of the things he made a point, and I've said this before, I had never had any criticism, you know, if he thinks official missed a call or something like that. I said, Jay, just don't miss a rule. If my guys interpret a rule correctly, I said, don't say that, you know, they did that wrong. But and he agreed with that. He says, I don't know the rules well enough, but... it was good.
Maybe we have to get Jay on here. We'll get him over to the...
Oh, that'd be terrific.
The palatial North Raleigh studio. And and have Jay defend himself, so I'm not doing it. But so it's taken us a while to get started here in 2020, but we'll get going now, and we got plenty to talk about. We'll have more next week. Maybe we'll even get some controversial calls or even an error we can talk about.
We will have a good one last thing. Every day I try to get online and look at, and it seems like every morning I look, somebody in the NBA is getting tossed. Two guys got tossed. Walker got used to play for Charlotte Hornets. Kemba. He got tossed last night, and T.J. Warren got tossed last night. They're just two that I know of, but it seems like. It's like,
didn't TJ get tossed when he was at State? Were you working then?
I was a supervisor. He may have gotten tossed. I'm
trying to remember. There was
was taking him to the cleaners most of the night, and that's why.
I'm trying to remember. I've lost it in the haze of memory. There was definitely a State player who got thrown out at Wake Forest. It might not have been TJ. I gotta go back. I gotta look it up. But we'll get back to it. Good talking to you, John. And
let's schedule our next one and go from there.
We'll do it soon. Thank you very much for listening. We're back, and we'll be back with episode 24 soon.